upholding scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. We're included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Now, let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. And greetings from Technocracy News and Trends. Patrick Wood here, Editor-in-Chief. And you probably recognize the voice of George H.W. Bush on that last clip. He talked frequently about the Agenda 21 back in those days when he was president. He talked about the United States being the global leader in the implementation of Agenda 21. This is exactly what plagues us today. This was globalization. This was the plan that they handed off to the United Nations purposely to infect the whole planet, not just the United States, but the whole world. We have three great stories today. We'll dive right into them. The first story is titled Judge, that is a judge in a court, in Florida in particular. DNA can be mined by police and government. I've said over the years that this is an inevitable outcome of collecting DNA privately from citizens all over America, but the world as well. And the big databases like Ancestry.com and 23andMe, and there are several others that are probably doing a service to people who pay to have their DNA analyzed and matched against potential family members that they didn't know existed. That's been a very popular thing over the years. But the warning has been, it's just a matter of time before the government cannot stand it anymore, nor the police departments and law enforcement, that they will dive in with everything they got to get their hands on that data. And you know, as a reader of Technocracy.News, that data is like heroin to a technocrat. They've got to have it. And whenever they see data that they can't get their hands on, they want it. So every time, for instance, a police department goes out and takes DNA from a suspect, the very first thing they want to do is go and match that DNA in these large public databases to find out who your family are, where you hail from, people they can go interview and talk to and find out where you are. Well, I wrote at the top of the story, massive private DNA databases are rapidly being pried open by law enforcement and government. Technocrat handlers are incapable of keeping their hands off of such a treasure trove of family trees. The article states, for police officers around the country, the genetic profiles that 20 million people have uploaded to consumer DNA sites represents a tantalizing resource that could be used to solve cases both old and new. But for years, the vast majority of data have been off limits to investigators. The two largest sites, Ancestry.com and 23andMe, have long pledged to keep their users' genetic information private, as they should, and a smaller one, GED Match, severely restricted police access to its records this year. Last week, however, a Florida detective announced at a police convention that he had obtained a warrant to penetrate GED Match and search its full database of nearly 1 million users. Legal experts said that this appeared to be the first time a judge had approved such a warrant and that the development could have profound implications for genetic privacy. That's a huge game changer, said Aaron Murphy, a law professor at New York University. The company made a decision to keep law enforcement out, and that's been overridden by a court. It's a signal that no genetic information can be safe. DNA policy experts said the development was likely to encourage other agencies to request similar search warrants from 23andMe, which has 10 million users, and Ancestry.com, which has 15 million. If that comes to pass, the Florida judge's decision will affect not only the users of these sites, but huge swaths of the population, including those who have never taken a DNA test. That's because this emerging forensic technique makes it possible to identify a DNA profile even through distant family relationships. Using public genealogy sites to crack cold cases had its breakthrough moment in April 2018 when the California police used GED Match to identify a man they believed is the Golden State Killer, Joseph James DeAngelo. After his arrest, dozens of law enforcement agencies around the country rushed to apply the method to their own cases. Investigators have since used genetic genealogy to identify suspects and victims in more than 70 cases of murder, sexual assault, and burglary, ranging from 5 decades to just a few months old. Most users of genealogy services have uploaded their genetic information in order to find relatives, learn about ancestors, and get insights into their health, not anticipating that the police might one day search for killers and rapists in their family trees. After a revolt by a group of prominent genealogists, GED Match changed its policies in May. It required law enforcement agents to identify themselves when searching its database, and it gave them access only to the profile of users who had explicitly opted in to such queries. As of last week, according to the GED Match co-founder Curtis Rogers, just 185,000 of the site's 1.3 million users had opted in. Like many others in law enforcement, Detective Michael Fields of the Orlando Police Department was disappointed by GED's Match policy shift. He had used the site last year to identify a suspect in a 2001 murder of a 25-year-old woman that he has spent 6 years trying to solve. Today, working with a forensic consulting firm, Parabon, Detective Fields is trying to solve the case of a serial rapist who assaulted a number of women decades ago. Well, enough of DNA for now. You can read the story and get the full skinny on it. I suggest you do, especially if you have submitted your own DNA to any of these services. They will eventually be prying into your past, whether you like it or not. And of course, the issue here is invasion of privacy means that people are snooping on you for no good reason. They're just looking around trying to find something else on somebody else. But what if they find something on you? Or what if they incorrectly misjudge something that you've entered or something about your DNA that ends up getting you inadvertently charged with a crime that you did not commit? This is very serious. There needs to be a public outcry on this, and there needs to be a public pushback of users of these sites like 23andMe and Ancestry.com. They need to resist this incursion of the government and police agencies. The next story is the height of pettiness, jaywalk shaming. You say, what is jaywalk shaming? Well, you know what jaywalking is. It's when you try and get across a street in a way that's not authorized. You're not following the rules. You're either walking against the light or you're walking kitty corner from corner to corner, which, of course, is not allowed. You're supposed to walk straight across at right angles. But in any case, in China, just try it, and you'll find your name and your face put up on an e-billboard to shame you publicly for having jaywalked. This is absolutely insane. I wrote, China's ubiquitous surveillance and identification system watches everything, everywhere for rule breakers and shames them in real time by displaying pictures with names on electronic billboards. Since the entire population has already been cataloged into a national database, identifying a single person takes only seconds. This is symptomatic of a technocracy at work. The article states, it's something that many people do without giving it a second thought. But if you jaywalk in China, you could be publicly shamed. Facial recognition technology is being used in several Chinese cities, including Shanghai and Shenzhen, which can spot people jaywalking and post their photo and ID to a huge billboard. Writer Matthew Brennan tweeted a shocking video of the strange system, although it remains unclear where it was filmed. He wrote, quote, Chinese facial recognition systems to discourage minor traffic violations. Cross the road when you shouldn't, and a picture of you with your name, ID card number, pop up on the big screen for everyone to see. His tweet has garnered over 3,000 retweets and almost 5,000 likes at the time of the writing of this article, with many replying to express their shock at the system. However, while it may be shocking to us, it's pretty commonplace for locals who've had to endure the system since 2018. That is, by the way, when it went live. We covered that story in the pages of Technocracy News and Trends. Speaking to Channel News Asia, Janine Wong, a news researcher in Shanghai, explained, "It doesn't matter if you're walking or riding a bicycle. Your picture will be captured and your face will show up on a screen nearby so everyone can see your face. Once they identify your face, all your information, like mobile phone number, is linked. Facial recognition is widely used, of course, across China, including at several airports." Now, on one hand, somebody might think, well, that's awfully petty of China to do this. Maybe they're just kind of running some tests on it to see how it works or whatever. But here's the backstory on this. Doing something so petty as putting people's pictures and names up because they jaywalk, it means that they can catch you in any crime where you can be photographed. In other words, it's a nudge to the rest of society to say, we're watching you. We can see you. We know what you're doing. Do you want your picture and your ID number and your phone number posted on a giant billboard? Say, oh, no, I wouldn't want that. Well, then don't jaywalk or don't do whatever else is bad that the state says is bad. It's pretty crazy. This kind of technology, by the way, is coming to America like a firestorm. Don't think it won't show up here. It's almost certain to, and it's just a matter of time. The last article, written by Brandon Smith of Alt Market, is an article that I saved to talk about last. I want to encourage you to go to the website and read this article word for word and read it more than one time if you don't get it the first time. Or if you just kind of rush through it, print it out and read it again when you're sitting in your easy chair at home, turn off the TV, and read this story very closely, very slowly, and you'll have some new revelations, I am sure. I wrote at the top of this article, my comments, Brandon Smith hit several nails squarely on the head, starting with the architects of modern globalism, like the Trilateral Commission member, Richard N. Gardner, who wrote The Hard Road to World Order in 1974. Not incidentally, this article, that is, Richard Gardner's article, provided the subtitle to my book, Technocracy, The Hard Road to World Order. That was a tip of the hat, if you will, to Richard Gardner back in those days when he wrote about his plans or his thoughts on how the New World Order was going to be established. He was a founding member of the Trilateral Commission, by the way, a professor, an academic, and he was fully into Zbigniew Brzezinski's technotronic era. The struggle we face, I wrote, is not for survival, but rather for prevailing over a twisted technocrat ideology run by twisted global elites who think they have some divine, if not satanic, right to rule over mankind with micromanaged precision. Smith correctly concludes, quote, freedom and the fight for peace and balance in the face of would-be emperors is an infinite battle. It never ends. The fight is freedom. Without the fight, freedom disappears. And this is absolutely correct. So I'm going to share with you this article. That doesn't replace the fact that you should go read it with your own eyeballs either, but I'm going to read it to you now, and you'll get the idea. He writes, activism in the liberty movement often requires a painful examination of details. We look at political and economic trends, identify inconsistencies in the mainstream narrative, point out inevitable outcomes of disaster or attempts at collectivist power, and ask, who benefits? Ultimately, the analysts and activists with any sense of observation come to the same conclusion. There is a contingent of financial elites embedded within the political world and the corporate world that have a specific ideology and malicious goals. They create most geopolitical and economic crisis events using puppets in government as well as influence in central banking. They then turn the consequences of these events to their advantage. This group is identified by their intent as well as by their associations. Their intent is utter dominance through globalism to the point that national borders are erased and all trade and governance flows through a single one-world edifice that they seek to control. As Richard N. Gardner, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizations under Kennedy and Johnson, and a member of the Trilateral Commission, wrote in the April 1974 issue of the Council on Foreign Relations journal, Foreign Affairs, in an article titled, The Hard Road to World Order. You have heard me repeat this particular phrase many times over the last several years. Quote, in short, this is Richard Gardner writing now, in short, the House of World Order will have to be built from the bottom up rather than from the top down. It will look like a great booming, buzzing confusion to use William James' famous description of reality, but an end run around national sovereignty, eroding it piece by piece, will accomplish much more than the old-fashioned frontal assault. Close quote. This quote, by the way, has been the essence of the heartbeat of technocracy, because it has been an end run around national sovereignty. Every step of the way, eroding sovereignty piece by piece, chipping away little by little, death by a thousand cuts, and we find ourselves in the situation that we are today, wondering what happened. How did we get here? Nobody seems to know. Well, I can tell you. Go back and read Richard Gardner. He laid it all out. And of course, he was just parroting what the Trilateral Commission had to say. They were trying to create, back then, a new international economic order. That's all there was. The NIEO. They wrote about it excessively. The problem is, even analysts like myself and Anthony Sutton really didn't know what they had in mind when they said new. Well, now we know. They meant technocracy. Brzezinski called it his technotronic era. But believe me, I've read the book again. It's technocracy. Smith continues in his article, they want to reinvent civilization and mold it into a homogenized and highly micromanaged global hive. Within this collective, they see themselves as not only the future masters of social evolution, but also as demigods that are worshipped by the masses, and they are willing to do almost anything to achieve this endgame. In an article I wrote last year titled Global Elitists Are Not Human, I outlined the connection between globalist ideology, globalist actions, and the psychology of narcissistic sociopaths, that is, narcopaths or psychopaths. I theorized that the globalists are in fact a stark example of tightly organized psychopathy. In other words, like a criminal cartel or cult, they are a group of psychopaths that have unified their efforts to become more efficient predators. And I'll add a little side comment here. The word efficient here, when it comes to predators, would seem to me to be that technology is the way to achieve efficiency. And indeed, that's what technocracy has done. They are much more efficient predators today, thanks to technocrat science, than they were, say, 50 years ago. The article continues. And like many psychopaths, they have conjured elaborate philosophical explanations for their abhorrent activities to the point that they seem to have developed their own disturbing brand of religion. There comes a moment in the life of many liberty movement activists or analysts when they are confronted with this reality, the reality that we are not fighting a faceless system that was built passively by mistake or built in the name of mere random greed. No, the system is only an extension of a greater agenda and the weapon of a conspiratorial army. What we are really fighting are very evil people with psychopathic desires to dominate and destroy. Attempt to change the system without removing the cabal behind it, and you will fail every time. Let me read that again. Attempt to change the system without removing the cabal behind it, and you will fail every time. We are living proof of that, because we have failed every time for decades. He continues, this is where we hit a wall of indecision and find ourselves at an impasse on solutions within the government. There are even some people who argue that nothing can be done. This is, of course, a lie. Something can indeed be done. We can fight and remove the elites from the equation entirely. In fact, we have no choice but to fight if we hope to retain any semblance of our sovereignty or foundational principles. But sadly, there are people in the movement with some influence who do not seem to understand the difference between fighting to survive and fighting to succeed. Let me break it down a little further, he writes. The liberty movement is obsessed with the concept of survival. We see the globalist efforts leading to the ruin of the common man's future, and we know that the threat is very real. So we prepare. We prepare to survive, but not necessarily to prevail. Survival itself is meaningless. There are many ways to stay alive. A person could just as easily sell out to the globalists and help them, and that person probably would have a better odds of survival than I will farming my homestead as a producer and living off my preps in defiance of them. If survival alone is your goal, then you are not a liberty activist and you have missed the bigger picture. Even in the event that you can weather the storm of economic chaos or political civil war safely in an isolated retreat somewhere on a far-off mountaintop, what kind of world will you be coming back to when you finally have to leave that idyllic castle? What kind of world will your children be coming back to, and their children? I'm certainly not dismissing the usefulness of survival culture. I'm a big proponent of it. But there are self-proclaimed survival gurus out there that are misleading the movement into thinking that survival is the final goal. And to this end, they have criticized people for organizing and preparing to fight the establishment. They claim it can't be done. We'll be wiped off the face of the earth, they say. The enemy is far too strong, and what can a mere rifle do against a tank? But if survivalism requires running away and hiding like a coward from a known evil or refusing to take action for the sake of future generations, then I don't want to be a survivalist. Freedom cannot be boiled down to a dream or a wish, something that might happen someday if we're able to stay alive long enough. Freedom is a responsibility that is already born into most human beings. It's not a cheesy or childish ideal, it's a timeless ideal. Freedom and the fight for peace and balance in the face of would-be emperors is an infinite battle. It never ends. The fight is freedom. Without the fight, freedom disappears. Just consider this now. The fight is freedom. Without the fight, freedom disappears. For each person that defies collectivists and totalitarians, even at the risk of their own life, the shadow is held back another day. This is what matters, and this is what survival purists don't get. You have to make yourself worthy of surviving by standing for principles and values that are bigger than you are. Otherwise, you're not worth a damn to anyone, even yourself. As for the notion of the impossible mountain, the lone rebel taking on a vast globalist army, this is not a delusional fantasy, and these people are not alone. There are millions of us out there, getting ready and forming pockets of resistance. In the meantime, we fight the information war, because the globalist's most powerful weapon is not a tank or even a nuclear bomb, it's propaganda. The ability to turn a population in on itself and cause it to self-destruct is far more dangerous than any technological advancement or military marvel. As a longtime mixed martial artist, I have seen the biggest and most intimidating opponents toppled by a clever strategy and willpower. There is no such thing as an unbeatable man, nor an unbeatable army. There is always a way to prevail. Finally, when I consider the claim made by some that beating the elites in a direct confrontation is a pipe dream, I have to ask the fundamental question. Why do these people assume that we have a choice? I've witnessed some pretty desperate attempts at silver bullet solutions to globalism in my years in the movement, from presidential election campaigns to change a system that cannot be changed from within to revolutionary cryptocurrencies that the banking elites happily invest in and co-opt. People misplace their faith in corrupt politicians and the rigged political process, even though they should know better by now. In the final analysis, politics is designed to keep society in stasis, frozen with inaction or fighting in the name of a false leader. Always, when the dust settles, the elites escape blame and scrutiny while the public picks up the pieces and tries to understand what just happened. The current chaos surrounding Donald Trump is no different. It is only different in that Trump is a puppet whose job is to appeal directly to liberty activists. For once, we're getting recognition, but it's not the good kind. And while building alternatives to the mainstream system and removing yourself from the grid is a step in the right direction, this alone is only stopgap. One day, the establishment will come to take what you have. There is no way around this. Narcopaths are like ravenous parasites feeding on every last morsel of humanity. They take over whatever can be taken. The question is, when they come to digest that which you hold precious, how will you respond? Is fighting back impossible? Or is it preferable to slavery? Is dying for a better tomorrow a fool's errand, or the only errand we are put on the earth for? These are questions that need to be answered, and answered soon. The time left to ponder them is running out. As I said, Brandon Smith has hit the nail squarely on the head. Multiple nails, actually. And I have nothing to add to this really myself. He's done a great job. People from every persuasion in our country should be chastised and admonished from this piece. We need to do some serious introspection and find out what our real motives are for trying to set America straight again. I've heard every piece of criticism, by the way, that Brandon Smith brings up in here. I've had it leveled at me more than one time over the years. I've heard it from all sides. And I have to say, it's never a welcome criticism. It's just discouragement is all it is. I shrug it off. I say we all should shrug it off. Those who fall prey to false criticism will only be discouraged, end up depressed, useless for any good work, and ultimately defeated. This is not the America that we started out with. And personally, I don't believe these are the Americans that we still have today. I think there are millions of Americans who still have backbone, but maybe they're just ignorant still of some of the things that we're talking about. But this battle is far from lost. And it may be lost in the end, in fact. But again, the question is your life and liberty worth everything to you? I think it should be. Historically, Americans have died in many wars over the decades to defend and protect our liberty. They gave everything. What are we willing to give? I don't think we have to be challenged to give everything today like they did, but it's time to make some sacrifices. It's time to get serious. It's time to lay the gauntlet down. Get after it. These people are not gods that we're fighting. They don't have supernatural powers. They put their pants on just like the rest of us do. Or if you're a gal, your skirts. They're no different, and they're just as vulnerable as everybody else. In the end of it, it'll be our will against theirs. And I say, at this point, we indeed do have the moral high ground. They do not, and they never will. I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. Have a great weekend. Catch you next week.